Hello everybody, this is Dr. Beter. Today is January 21, 1976, and this is my monthly audio letter number 8. As we begin to celebrate the bicentennial of our independence, let us reflect for a moment on our past. Out of a vast wilderness, our people created a nation with astonishing speed. Our forefathers brought forth a nation with the highest and most stable form of self-government ever conceived by man. It was unique in the entire world, a prescription for freedom, simple enough for everyone to understand, yet truly a work of genius. It's no wonder that from our earliest days as an independent nation, the eyes of the entire world have been riveted on the United States of America. What was initially called our noble experiment was spectacular in its success, and America's banner of freedom became a symbol of hope for oppressed peoples everywhere. Would any of this have happened without the clear patriotic vision of our founding fathers? Could it have come to pass without the courage of George Washington, who in 1776 led the famous surprise attack on the far stronger British forces in Trenton? Would we have had our inspired and inspirational Constitution if Benjamin Franklin's call for prayer had not broken the impasse over representation at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787? Could we ever have had a government sensitive to the wishes of the people if the humility of our early leaders had been replaced with the arrogant boasting practiced by our corrupt rulers of today? And would we have had a nation such as ours if our founding fathers had believed in the internationalism promoted today by the Rockefeller brothers? What would our founding fathers say today if they could see us meddling in the affairs of other countries? How would they feel about the tremendous sacrifices they endured if they could see our rulers of today building up another nation to become our slave master at our own expense? We would all do well to look back once again at the patriotic words of George Washington in his farewell address as president. He advised his countrymen to extend commercial relations to foreign nations with as little political connection as possible. He did not advise against such commercial relations in themselves, nor did he object to temporary alliances with foreign nations when needed in an emergency. But he did give us a clear, strong warning that has an urgent relevance to us today, and I quote, to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world. Is this rule being followed today by our Rockefeller rulers and their client followers? Since 1917, the Rockefeller Empire has been allied with the Soviet Union, with which we are to be merged against our will, and with the Soviets ultimately in the driver's seat. As I explained last month, and have often discussed on other occasions, we the people are the victims of an alliance between state socialism in Russia and corporate socialism here under the Rockefeller brothers. And, my friends, this is not an informal arrangement. Since at least the early days of the Eisenhower administration, which was actually run behind the scenes by Nelson Rockefeller, there has been a White House directive which I am about to reveal to you for the very first time. It is short, but not sweet. It establishes as a prime goal of federal policy, and I quote here, to so alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with life in the Soviet Union." Unquote. My friends, I do not merely challenge, I dare President Ford or anyone else in the White House to deny the existence of this directive under oath. But they won't do so unless they have become so desperate that they are willing to gamble on any bluff. Because I have access to documentary evidence on this matter that could immediately convict them for perjury and lead to impeachment and or prison. Yes, this short White House directive, my friends, quote, "to so alter life in the United States that it can be comfortably merged with life in the Soviet Union," unquote. That's the key to all of our domestic and foreign policy today. It explains why we have become the factory for the Soviet Union. It explains why so many multinational corporations are being used to build up the Soviet economy while depressing our own. It explains why the many huge Rockefeller-controlled tax-exempt foundations, which are all working in this direction, are immune to prosecution for their flagrant violation of their charters. It explains why the Rockefeller-controlled banks and financial institutions are so single-mindedly financing the Soviet juggernaut at American taxpayer expense. It is little wonder that Nobel Prize-winning biologist George Wald, in an article a year ago about the runaway power of the multinational corporations, said, and I quote, "Hence no nation so closely resembles the United States as the Soviet Union," unquote. My fellow citizens, it is essential that we halt this horrible slippage backward into tyranny. If we are to survive as a free people beyond this our bicentennial year, we the people must rise up and make the government that belongs to us turn its face forward once again to the still new, still fresh ideals and principles that launched our great nation. I am absolutely convinced that we can still do it, if we will. Last month, I recorded audiobook number 6, entitled, "What We Can Do to Save America," to explain the strategy which I believe can and will do the job. And already, alert citizens all over America are listening to this message, getting to work and making suggestions. If you will join in the task, we can do it. Meanwhile, I intend to keep informing you about what we are up against, how events are progressing, and what plans are being formed behind the scenes. To this end, I want to talk to you today about 3 topics that all reflect the drive to merge life in America with that in the Soviet Union. Topic number 1, our charges for a citizen's indictment on the Fort Knox twin scandal cover-up. Topic number 2, Rockefeller progress and problems in their drive to drag our economy down to the Soviet level. And topic number 3, so-called detente and the ignored prophetic warnings of George Washington. Topic number 1. It is essential that I give special attention to the first topic today, but I will deal with the remaining 2 topics as fully as I can in the time that remains for them. Almost 2 years ago, in April 1974, during congressional testimony before a subcommittee of the House Banking and Currency Committee, I first revealed that the bullion depository at Fort Knox had been looted of its gold. I stood ready to present evidence to substantiate my charges, but nothing whatever was done. Having been failed by Congress, I then took my story to the public through lectures, radio talk shows, and publication of my charges in a national weekly newspaper. Faced by this public pressure, the government responded by setting in motion a well-orchestrated cover-up, a cover-up far more massive and more serious than that of the Watergate scandal, which removed our last elected president from office. The actual cover-up began on September 23, 1974, with the carefully staged visit of congressmen and newsmen to Fort Knox. I have detailed the ensuing cover-up, among other things, in my audiobook number 2 on the Fort Knox gold scandal and what it means to you. I have also given you continuing updates since June 1975 by means of my monthly audio letter. In October 1975, I revealed what I had just learned at that time that makes a twin super scandal of the Fort Knox situation, namely, the presence of about 60 pounds of radioactive liquid super poison processed from deadly plutonium-239 in the central core vault of the bullion depository at Fort Knox. The canisters of poison, put there in 1968 by the CIA, are corroding and leaking faster and faster, endangering the health and even the lives of millions of Americans in the southeastern United States. The government's response to this second, far more serious half of the Fort Knox scandal has been the same as to the first, cover-up. I've explained in recent months how first Senator Frank Church and then Congressman Otis Pike, chairman respectively of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, have become parties to the Fort Knox plutonium scandal cover-up, and how bureaucratic gobbledygook is being used by government officials to avoid giving straight, honest answers about the situation. But now, the Fort Knox scandal cover-up is getting even worse. It has recently entered a new phase of outright lying and of masking the evidence concerning my charges. They are going for broke, and they have long since passed the point of no return. The same tactics of lying and cheating by the government that are standard practice in the Soviet Union, into which we are to be merged, are now being used here in the United States, and these tactics are far more effective here than in Russia, because Americans, unlike Soviet citizens, have not yet learned to expect their government to lie to them continuously. Up till now, the main cover-up approach has been one of evasion, but now an atmosphere of desperation on the part of the wrongdoers is becoming increasingly apparent. For the very first time, Treasury Secretary William Simon has made the fatal mistake of actually lying, in writing no less, about a crucial matter, the existence of the central core vault of the bullion depository at Fort Knox. We have challenged the government to either confirm or deny its existence in the past, and we have identified it not only by this name, central core vault, but also by describing it to avoid any possibility of misunderstanding due to terminology. In a letter to a friend of mine, dated December 10, 1975, Simon said the following, and I quote, "The allegation that plutonium-239 is, or ever has been, stored at Fort Knox in a central core vault is false, and the Army has just conducted an extensive test of the Bulleen Depository and has found no evidence of radioactivity. I should add that there is no such thing as the Central Core Vault." Unquote. Notice that Simon's denial of the presence of plutonium-239 at the depository is tied right in with his denial of the existence of the Central Core Vault. Obviously, if there is no Central Core Vault, then it cannot contain plutonium-239. But on the other hand, to have any faith that his denial about the plutonium is truthful, you must also believe his assertion that there exists no Central Core Vault at the depository. If he would lie about one, he would lie about the other. With that in mind, please listen now to an excerpt from another letter, this one written to one of my associates by a retired Lieutenant General John L. Ryan, Jr., a former commanding general of Fort Knox. General Ryan probably knows more about the depository than anyone else who ever commanded Fort Knox. He spent 2 tours of duty there before he returned a third time as the commanding general. And when the gold was moved to Fort Knox to be stored there for the very first time in 1937, it was he who was placed in charge of the actual physical movement of the incoming gold into the depository. With regard to the disputed Central Core Vault, he says, quote, "When I use the word vault, I am referring to the central core of the depository, where the bullion was stored. This vault was below ground level and could be entered only through a specially constructed bank-type door that opened onto a screw lift. This door was in the receiving shipping area of the depository. The receiving shipping room was above ground level. The vault was below ground level. Around the vault proper, or central core, below ground level was a passageway. On this passageway were a number of cell-like compartments. There was no means of entering the vault from this passageway." Unquote. My friends, the passageway with its compartments are all that the visitors saw in September 1974. The existence of the central core vault, which is where the gold, if any, should have been, is absolutely confirmed by General Ryan. And as his letter makes clear, the 1974 visitors had no chance of finding out about it while wandering around in the passageway and looking at the small compartments you heard and read about in the news. Such bold-faced lying is bad enough, but the mounting desperation of the Rockefeller brothers and their lackeys over Fort Knox now goes even beyond mere lying. It is standard practice, whenever an extremely damaging secret is in danger of exposure, to distract attention from it and confuse the issue by deliberately exposing something else, something far less serious and dangerous than the secret being hidden, yet shocking enough to satisfy the public's appetite for the truth. With our totally manipulated government of today, a good rule of thumb is, whenever something that looks really damaging is revealed, ask yourself, why are they letting this out of the bag? What is it that is worse than they are trying to distract my attention from? Thus, for example, Senator Church's sensational revelations last summer about deadly shellfish toxins and the like fooled many into believing they had been given the whole ugly truth about CIA misdeeds. But actually, he was covering up what he knew about the insane nuclear superpoison at Fort Knox, something 1,000 times worse than anything he revealed. Now, in the same way, a cover-up campaign has been launched in regard to the leakage of the plutonium-239 superpoison from Fort Knox, and it's horrible. A few days ago, on January 12, 1976, a truck carrying radioactive waste just happened to have an accident in eastern Kentucky, smack in the heart of the area now most heavily affected by radioactive poison leakage from Fort Knox. 14 of the 32 drums of waste on the truck fell off, and 8 of them broke open and leaked. The newspaper stories around there about it contained the usual assurances that there was no danger, that it had been cleaned up and so forth, but leakage had occurred. Just 6 days later, on January 18, newspapers contained a big article about still another alleged radioactive waste leakage problem in Kentucky. The truck I mentioned a moment ago had been on its way to a nuclear waste dumping ground at Maxey Flats, Kentucky, which had been in use since 1963. And now we are suddenly told that the leakage is occurring there too. Federal investigators, those wonderful watchdogs we are supposed to trust and admire, claim that radioactive waste in steel, wooden, and even cardboard drums has been just dropped into trenches and covered up with dirt. And after 12 years, they have just now abruptly discovered that some of it has gotten loose and is spreading through the ground, through the water, and through the air. And a study by the General Accounting Office, while it gives the standard assurance that there is no immediate danger, recommends a crash program to correct the situation and develop systematic standards for safe disposal of radioactive waste. Now, why all this sudden concern about leakage of radioactive contamination? And why does the spotlight on actual leakage cases just happen to be on Kentucky? After all, there are vastly more serious problems of this sort elsewhere in the United States, for example, in New York State, but so why Kentucky? Two reasons, my friends. For one thing, they are using the opportunity to continue the nuclear con game that has been pulled on you for years by assuring you, even when there are nuclear waste leakages, that you don't really have to worry about it. But more importantly, in my monthly audio letter number 7 last month, I posed a direct challenge to the federal government to either prove or disprove my charges, and I spelled out a fair, objective way to do it. What is going on now is their answer to my challenge. By spreading stories about other kinds of radioactive waste leakage in the general vicinity of Fort Knox, and possibly by deliberately causing such releases, such as occurred in the truck accident, they are feverishly tampering with the evidence. The program I suggested, to use off-site measurements to detect leakage from the bullion depository at Fort Knox, would, as they can now argue, no longer prove anything conclusively about my charges because of these other radioactive leakages which allegedly have also suddenly been discovered in the same region. I, for one, would like to see the whole business about Fort Knox laid to rest once and for all, and I know you would too. I know that my charges about the gold and about the plutonium poison are true, but for the sake of argument, if I were wrong, I would rather be honestly proven wrong about any or all of them and be made a laughingstock than to have the American people's worry over this matter dragged out endlessly like this. Whatever the truth is, I want you to know. But the Rockefeller lackeys in the government know only too well that the truth is exactly what I have told you, and they don't want you to know. They will do anything and everything to try to save themselves, regardless of how many other human beings they may doom in the process. And so, my friends, this is the vicious reality behind the smooth mask that our Rockefeller-controlled federal government wears. We the people must bring the pressure to bear that will cause these things to be honestly investigated and corrected. The United States is under the thumb of modern outlaws, and if we do not bring them to justice, they will bring us and our children to total ruin. So far, the United States Congress has not seen fit even to consider my charges about the gold, about the plutonium, about anything. The problem is not that I don't have the evidence, but that I have too much of it. The same applies to the Justice Department, the General Accounting Office, the White House, and so on and so on. But recently, a congressman who heard my testimony in Congress about the missing Fort Knox gold in April 1974 and who went to Fort Knox in September 1974 gave us a tiny opening, whether wittingly or unwittingly. His constituents have been pressing him continuously for some answers about Fort Knox, and in recent replies which were forwarded to me, he in effect challenged us to do exactly what we have wanted to do for nearly 2 years, to present our charges and evidence in a proper legal forum. Our response is a 6-page open letter by my able co-patriot, Mr. Edward Durell of Berryville, Virginia. The letter is addressed to Congressman John B. Conlon of Arizona, but it is open because based on past performance, we have little reason for optimism that he will take any constructive action unless he is forced to do so by public pressure. The letter presents charges which parallel completely, even in legal form, the impeachment charges leveled at President Nixon by the House of Representatives. It is a legal document, and you are the nationwide grand jury. Under our Constitution, it is ultimately we, the people who constitute the highest human authority in our land, and it is up to you to decide. Do our charges deserve an open, complete, honest investigation in a proper legal form or not? If so, it is up to you to return a citizen's indictment by demanding that your elected representatives provide a legal forum through congressional investigation or formal grand jury proceedings. Here now is Mr. Durell's letter to Congressman Conlon of Arizona. I will be quoting from the letter from here on, all the way to Mr. Durell's signature.